The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rumsfeld movie came out, people would invidiously compare it to the Fog of War good, Unknown bad. Why? One person said to me, because, and I'm an anti-redemption guy, I don't really believe in redemption. Why? Because McNamara said he was sorry. Maybe they're crocodile tears, however you want to describe it. He indicated a level of remorse about what he had done in the past, whereas Rumsfeld did not. I guess that's another index, how you evaluate films, particularly films about historical figures. How much remorse do they show, unless they're undisputable good guy figures?
I'm Matthew Kahn, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 21st, 2019. Errol Morris is a celebrated documentarian whose films have covered an array of topics in law and national security. They include The Fog of War, which won an Oscar for its account of Robert McNamara's role in and lessons from the Vietnam War, and The Unknown Known, which told the story of the political career of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Morris most recently directed American Dharma, a documentary profile of former Trump strategist Steve Bannon. And earlier this year, Morris sat down with Lawfare founding editor and Harvard Law professor Jack Goldsmith for a conversation about those three films. They talked about what interested Morris about McNamara, Rumsfeld, and Bannon, why Morris believed each of them agreed to be interviewed by him, and much more. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 428. Errol Morris on documenting Bannon.
So first question is, I want to focus for our readers on the McNamara, Rumsfeld, and Bannon.
Why those three? Why McNamara? I know you had other projects going on, but, you know, McNamara was a fantastic film. Rumsfeld kind of makes sense when he comes along your path. And now another focus on a single important Washington person, Bannon. Is there anything that brings these three together, or are they just random films that you made over the years?
They're not random films, but I'm not sure there's anything that brings them together. I had a deal with Bravo to do a television series, and I had fulfilled my contract, and there was a little money left over, and I thought, well, I'll do another interview, because under the terms of the contract, I got to keep it. I didn't have to give it to them. So McNamara had just published yet another book, and he was on a book tour, evidently. I called him, said I would very much like to interview him, and he said yes. He said yes, in retrospect, I know. He said yes because he thought I was just part of the book tour. And so a couple of weeks went by, and I get a call from Robert S. McNamara telling me he's talked it over with some of his friends, and he's thought about it, and he's decided he doesn't want to do the interview. I was told it would be a very, very bad idea talking to you. And he goes on and on and on and on, giving me all of the reasons why he is not going to do the interview. And at the very, very end, he says, but I said I'd do it, so I will do it. And I later told this to a friend of mine. He said, oh, yeah, I know that story. That's the story of Vietnam.
Excellent.
And he came. I mean, I could go on and on and on about this. He told me he would give me 10 minutes. And he sat down. After complaining about my interviewing device, the Interitron.
It's obvious in the film, he's into it. He was completely into it. He was enjoying himself.
I was enjoying myself.
Was that true in the Rumsfeld and Bannon films?
It's true in the Bannon film. It was occasionally true in the Rumsfeld film. But I had enormous difficulties with Rumsfeld.
What were the difficulties?
It was never clear to me who I was talking to. And in the end, it wasn't really clear whether I was talking to anybody.
You didn't think you were getting the real Rumsfeld, or there was no real Rumsfeld to get?
It's the old Gertrude Stein line about Oakland. There's no there there. There is a there there, but there is no there there. So much of it was just performance, no content. My favorite line in the movie, my favorite line during the interview, I asked him about the end of the Vietnam War, the closing of the American embassy in Saigon, the helicopters, blah, blah, blah. The end of one of the worst, of course, this is a competitive category, one of the worst debacles in American history. And I asked him, it's a stupid thing to ask, but I asked it anyway. What'd you learn? There he is in the Oval Office with Gerald Ford, Henry Kissinger, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What'd you learn? And his answer could be explained in so many different ways. The answer was, some things work out, some things don't, that didn't. So you could explain that in one way as a form of fuck you. Stupid question, stupid answer. But I started to think that the answer was real. And that I found even more disturbing. That it wasn't a fuck you answer. It was an answer.
What's wrong with it as an answer?
Because I would like to think that in the position that he was in, you would learn something more than just that.
But he could have been saying, these decisions are really hard. He did say something like this in the movie. You never really know in advance how it's going to work out. You can do your best ex ante. And he could have been just saying, it just didn't work out. Now, that's not a very satisfying explanation of what happened in Vietnam or the American commitment to Vietnam. And it's especially poignant coming on the heels of the fog of war, where McNamara was really seeming to try to grapple with what happened and to think it through and to try to figure out what went wrong. So the juxtaposition is pretty remarkable.
Striking.
And that for me went to the essence of the difference between the two films. Because in a way you're kind of doing similar things with the two films, very different periods, but similar things. And McNamara seemed genuinely interested. You know, you never know how genuine, but genuinely interested in revisiting it and thinking it through at least to some level, to a remarkable degree, I think. Second-guessing himself to some degree, and Rumsfeld had no interest in that, it seemed.
Yeah. When the Rumsfeld movie came out, people would invidiously compare it to the Fog of War good, Unknown Known bad. Why? One person said to me, because, and I'm an anti-redemption guy, I don't really believe in redemption. Why? Because McNamara said he was sorry. Maybe they're crocodile tears. However you want to describe it, he indicated a level of remorse about what he had done in the past, whereas Rumsfeld did not. I guess that's another index, how you evaluate films, particularly films about historical figures. How much remorse do they show, unless they're undisputable good guy figures. You make a movie about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Everybody loves Ruth Bader Ginsburg. How can you say anything bad about such a woman? But in this case, these wars, that somehow cloud the reputation. Vietnam, Iraq.
But is it your job as a filmmaker to extract?
No, I'm not. Threat? I'm a Jew boy from Long Island. I am not a Catholic priest. I'm not there to hear confession.
So it seems like to me, when I'm looking at the reviews, this is a little reductive, but the reviews of the three movies, people were disappointed that you weren't, some people were disappointed that you weren't harder on or extract more pledges of regret from Rumsfeld and Bannon, whereas you got a little bit from McNamara. I just think that's a function of the audience that is criticizing you. As you said, these are three villains in a way, different kinds of villains. And you got some regret and remorse out of one of them and not from the other two. And you kind of, you got taken to task a little bit for it, I think.
My answer, one interview about The Unknown Known, about the Rumsfeld film, was you make a movie with the Secretary of Defense that you have, not the Secretary of Defense you want to have.
So for what it's worth, I think you did. I think that there is a there for Rumsfeld. And I think you captured it. Now, he was being a little bit playful, more playful and glib, and a little less serious with you, I think. Well, that's not fair. His book actually did have some mild regret, his memoir after Pentagon, about the way that they ran the war, the way that they maybe should have gone to Congress more. He did express some mild regret about some of the things he'd said and did. Not much. But he's not someone who is in, he's just not someone who's inclined to readjudicate and beat himself up for things. And some people are like that. I mean, and I think, I don't understand why you think that you didn't get to a real person. What was it? Because it seemed like the Rumsfeld that I've spent a little bit of time with, what did you find missing from him as a human being? It sounds like that's what the problem was.
Now I wonder whether I'm being fair. You go through so many changes when you make movies like this. What do I really think? What am I supposed to think? What would people like me to think? He was very, very difficult to interview. Well, I set these constraints on the nature of what I was doing from the outset. I knew that Rumsfeld was very proud of all of the memos that he had written over the years, the Yellow Perils, the Snowflakes, Yellow Perils during the Ford administration, Snowflakes during the George W. Bush.
It used to be my job when I worked in the Defense Department to answer some of those snowflakes.
There you go. So I was fascinated by the snowflakes and by the Yellow Perils. And Rumsfeld had maybe not put all of them online, but he had put many of them online.
Right.
And he offered to show me even more. So I thought, what if I make a movie that's just based on Rumsfeld's Snowflakes and Yellow Perils, which is what I did. And it is a movie in part about the gobbledygook of Rumsfeldian language. Rumsfeld, in trying to explain the unknown known, kind of gets it all half backwards. And I like that moment. You could technically say that he gets lost in his own bullshit. And we could talk about this. It's one of the things that really interests me, because I became obsessed, I think would be the correct word, with a lot of these Rumsfeldisms. The one that I have thought a great deal about is the absence of evidence is an evidence of absence, because it was one of those cornerstones. It was one of the justifications for our invasion of Iraq.
You're referring to the WMD in Iraq. That's what it was a reference to, right?
That's correct.
Okay. What did you take that to mean? And do you think it's a valid statement?
I wondered where that statement came from. I knew that he had sent a snowflake to George W. Bush, and I imagined Bush reading this thing. You know, come again? So I wanted to know where this came from. What were the origins of this expression? What was it used for in the past? Its etiology, if you like. Well, I tracked it down to Carl Sagan and Martin Rees. Martin Rees.
I don't know who that is. Who's Martin Rees?
Martin Rees is an OM, astronomer royal, head of the Royal Society, master of Trinity College, and on and on and on and on and on. And I kind of know Martin Rees. I know him through working on the film that I made about Stephen Hawking, Brief History of Time. So I called Martin Rees and I asked him about it. I wrote this up for the New York Times, by the way. What was going on in your head? He said, it's an unexceptional statement. I don't see any problem with it at all. It seems fine. Now, think about the context for a moment. The context, of course, is there intelligent life somewhere else in the universe? And you say, well, we haven't found any evidence for intelligent life somewhere else in the universe. That is, if there is intelligent life here, well, it's a little presumptuous, but let's go with the idea. But that doesn't mean just because we haven't found evidence of this that it doesn't exist. So absence of evidence is an evidence of absence. So I get it.
But does it apply? You don't think it applies to Iraq?
No. So there's this obituary written by Bertrand Russell, Wittgenstein's obituary, which I'm very, very fond of. He's talking about how with Wittgenstein, he could never really decide whether he was a quack or a genius.
And you can say the same about Russell, actually.
Russell was a genius. You cannot.
He had some quackery elements, I think. But
he may have had some
quackery elements. Wittgenstein was a genius, too. Anyway. Keep going. I'm sorry.
Could be a discussion. See, he tells a story about how they're talking about, is there a hippopotamus in the lecture hall? And Wittgenstein says, well, you can't prove it one way or the other. And Russell goes around the lecture hall, looks under tables and chairs, opens a closet door. No hippopotamus. I conclude there is no hippopotamus in the lecture hall. So here's the question for you. You tell me. And I think Russell is right. Russell is right. You look around for the hippopotamus, the rhinoceros, whatever, you don't find it. It isn't there. So let's think about boundary conditions or scope. Would you say that the size of the universe is closer to Iraq or is the size of a lecture hall or your bedroom?
Well, that's funny because I would have actually said, in thinking about the analogy, I was thinking that the universe was more, this is not a defense of Rumsfeld. I'll tell you why I think that statement was wrong-headed or inappropriate, what I think about that. But there are a lot of places in Iraq that they didn't search. And, you know, a room, a lecture room, there's only, you can actually search it, everything, and come to some conclusions about a large object.
Agreed.
Very quickly, whereas still might be like finding a needle in a haystack if you're looking through a rock. But I think the reason that statement was inappropriate is because of the glibness about the evidentiary basis for what proved to be a disastrous invasion. That's what was wrong about the statement. Technically, it's true. Your friend in Cambridge is right. Technically, the fact that they didn't find it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, is what he's in effect saying. The question is whether that's the right attitude to have about evidence that was represented as the premise for this region-changing war. What do you think?
I think you're right, but I also think that the statement is misleading because if you're dealing with a small enough thing, it makes sense. The bigger that thing becomes, the less and less sense it makes. And in fact, there was a lot of evidence for the absence. Now, can I argue with you that Iraq is a big enough place? There's lots of, you know, it's the Thomas English Muffins, the nooks and crannies idea. There are all of these places where these things could be hidden, but there was considerable amount of evidence that there were no WMD. And they were playing on a kind of, I think, idiotic thinking. Discount all of this. You know, suddenly the skeptical argument, just because we haven't found any doesn't mean there isn't any, held sway.
You think it held sway in this country? I think that the Bush administration was, I don't think it held sway. I mean, it was a disaster.
We went to war.
It didn't hold sway after the fact. I mean, the question what we knew ex ante and what turned out to be the case after the fact are two different things. And I thought you were talking about whether ex post, after the fact, there turned out to be a valid evidentiary basis for the invasion. The The answer is no. The claimed premise for the invasion turned out not to be true. And he was being glib about that fact. But ex ante, I think it was much more complicated.
Maybe that's the heart of the problem, that there was a kind of glibness that bothered me.
Same with the Vietnam statement.
I used to say that he was the least Jewish person I had ever met. No self-loathing, no skepticism, no doubt. A different kind of critter from me.
So I didn't spend a lot of time with him, but what little time I spent in rooms with him, he was, this is going to maybe be surprising, and I'm not saying it was characteristic, but he was the most probing and skeptical person. He was a very confident guy. He was very demanding on the people in the room with him about information. He was probing and skeptical and questioning. So I think that that representation that came across in your movie doesn't really capture him. And I think, frankly, it's pretty apparent in some of those snowflakes. That famous snowflake where he's asking, are we winning more than we're losing in Iraq and all that?
Yeah.
That's, he was more like that in my experience, always questioning what we're doing. And less, although obviously at certain points he was dead confident and not questioning himself, certain very important points, and that's the person that came across in your movie. And I'm sure that's the way he represented himself. But in my thin experience, he was a more interesting and self-doubt's not the right word, but probing person.
The probing I could never... Look, I don't really claim to have any deep understanding of any of these people. I mean, I spent a fair amount of time with McNamara, with Bannon, with Rumsfeld. That word summarizes all of it. The glibness, the self-satisfaction.
So our audience is tend to be people interested in national security professionals, experts, journalists. I want to move on to Bannon, but before I do, you were talking about how you expected McNamara and Rumsfeld to draw lessons from these hugely important experiences. Are you able to have takeaway lessons from each of those movies? Is that too reductive? I mean, what were the main lessons you learned? These were two secretaries of defense presiding over two hugely consequential periods in American history, recent American history, presiding over wars that I think it's fair to say both proved to be disastrous. I assume that one of the reasons you set out to interview these people and make these films is to figure out what they learned from those experiences. McNamara seemed to reflect on that more than...
What I could learn from what they learned or didn't learn.
Yeah. And so what did you learn from what they did learn or didn't learn?
There's a despairing quality in all of these films. No one comments on the despair and the fog of war.
McNamara's despair or the despair of the film?
I would say both. Very near the end of the film, and this is an ironic line for me, McNamara says, rationality will not save us. Coming from him in particular, I think it's a devastating line because he had built his entire life on reasoning through problems. If rationality will not save us, what will? And I think the answer is nothing.
Nothing will. If the super rational, super smart people running the government blow it as badly as he did. I thought the most damning or revealing part of the movie was that statement for the reasons you just said. And also this aha that he had that, wow, we were looking at this through a Cold War lens and they thought it was a revolution, a domestic revolution, you know, and that occurred to him late in life. And it's just an extraordinary thing to say. It's great that he learned it, but that statement combined with the rationality statement really does make one despair. And then especially when juxtaposed against the giant mistake that was made in 2003.
And I was obsessed, still am by and large, by the Gulf of Tonkin incidents in 1964. I remember as an undergraduate reading I.F. Stone in the New York Review of Books had written these articles about Gulf of Tonkin, the resolution that followed that authorized war or seemingly authorized the war.
It did authorize it. It was clearly authorized.
It was clearly authorized.
It's a liberal myth that Congress didn't authorize the Vietnam War. You made that clear in your film.
Yes. So then the questions remained Were there two incidents in the Gulf of Tonkin or only one?
Right.
And if there was only one, who knew that and when? Now, if you listen to Johnson's phone calls during that period of time, it's pretty clear to me that Johnson knew it, that there was no second attack. During my interview with McNamara, I asked him, why did you change in retrospect? He said, I didn't change from the hardback to the paperback. He said, I didn't change it at all. I said, well, what about the footnote on the Gulf of Tonkin? He said, oh, that. He said, because he learned for the first time when he was in Hanoi in the 90s that that attack had not occurred.
Did you believe him?
It brings me to something that really deeply fascinates me. It's really behind all of the work that I do, is self-deception. Do I believe that McNamara convinced himself that he didn't know it? I kind of do. But can I answer that one way or the other? I find it extraordinary that he wouldn't know.
So what you just said, that your a lot of your films are about self-deception, I think that captures it for me, what's great about the films.
Maybe including my own. I wouldn't exempt myself.
Yourself? Well, we'll get to that. but you really have them there, right in the camera, asking them, and you only have a few shots at this, and you got it a couple of times. And it's clear when they're answering, this is true of Rumsfeld more than McNamara, but even Finn sometimes. It's true that you ask the right question, you have them there on camera, and you can see in their face that either they're lying or they don't understand that they're deceiving themselves, and you can see it, and it comes through. And we are all like this to some degree, but you capture that in some very important moments.
Well, that's a nice thing to hear.
I thought it was this, and it, having that face right in the middle of the screen, and you can watch every little facial expression, and the camera stays, I'm no film person, but the camera stays zoomed in for a long time, and the little twitches and the little pauses, and it really, it seems to me that's a theme that's on the surface throughout all of this. Self-deception, and also, can we ever really know the truth? I mean, that's an obvious theme, but it's so much of those two films and the Bannon film, which we'll get to in a second, seem to have that theme. I want to move on to Bannon if I can, the Bannon film. So it's called, can you just say what the status of it is? I don't understand what, I don't know if this is a painful topic, but what is it?
Well, it most certainly is a painful topic.
Okay, well, do you mind talking about it?
Not at all.
So what's the deal? You make a film, you're a famous filmmaker, it's a great film, what's the deal? The film is called American Dharma, and we'll talk about what that means in a second. But can you explain why this film has not been publicly available?
I knew there was going to be trouble, but I thought a routine amount of trouble. Same trouble that I had with McNamara film, with Rumsfeld film, that it would be no different in kind. I was wrong. The film premiered at the Venice Film Festival, and either the day or 2 days before the premiere, David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, disinvited Steve Bannon from the New Yorker Festival. Why did he disinvite him? Because many of his writers complained. And I assume, although I do not know for sure, that it wasn't just his writers, maybe his advertisers, who knows? There were complaints.
Right.
And he acceded to those complaints and disinvited him. By doing that, I don't want to place all of the blame on him, but I'd like to place some of the blame on him. By doing that, he made it possible for others to do the same. It became a kind of thing to do. Hey, let's disinvite this guy. Let's say, Steve Bannon, we don't like you. We don't like your policies. Don't come anywhere near us. We don't want to talk to you. We don't want to hear from you. We don't want to think about you. It's one of the stranger experiences that I've had. And I've had a number of strange experiences over the years.
This is a general phenomenon that I can't, and I want to talk about it after we get into the film a little bit, but because it's really remarkable. It wasn't really a backdrop, but it kind of was the backdrop. This is an edgy thing to do, to have a feature documentary film about Bannon. at least in your world, I think, which I take it to be the kind of world of progressive filmmaking or filmmaking which has a progressive tilt.
Here's a really simple way to look at it. I like thinking about this stuff. And making a film, without really knowing what the film is going to be, what's going to be said, what's going to be edited out, what's going to be included, without knowing in advance, it's investigative.
Yeah.
It's an opportunity to find out something I don't know. And I love doing it.
What do you make of the fact that in America in 2019, this film is out of bounds? It's an amazing thing, really. This guy, whatever you think of him, he's been very consequential. He was very consequential in Trump's election campaign. He was less consequential, I think, maybe than even you give him credit for in the administration. He's still, there's a question about whether he is the pie chart thing, how much of him is the real deal and how much of him is
huckster. Yeah, what percentage of the pie is snake oil salesman, right. What percentage is true believer?
All fair questions, but he's a consequential person and he has access to and insight into a very important part of the American population. Donald Trump was elected president and it's just being shut out from a lot of places. And you have credibility in that world, enormous, the most enormous amount of credibility, and yet he's still shut out. It's really a remarkable comment on the state of public debate in this country.
Evidently it is. There was an editor at Knopf who wanted me to write a book. People still are asking me to write about the fact that, now this may change in the next week or so because there is now some interest in distribution, but I went to the Venice Film Festival. This is in early September last year. There was a standing ovation, honest to God, through the entire credit sequence of the movie. I've never seen anything like this before. That night, I read one of the most savage reviews that I've ever received from someone who has praised my films in the past. Among other things, they called it a bromance.
That it was not.
My bromance with Stephen Bannon. And no one would come anywhere near the film. I'm talking about distributors.
Right, now. Right. What were they worried about? I want to move to the film after this, but what were they worried about? Were they worried about retaliation? Are they going to lose business on some other dimension? Do they worry about going home to their families and being harassed? Or I don't understand what the mechanisms are.
I think all of the above. I've heard so many stories. One distributor said that all of the young people working in his office would get up and leave if he were to take this film.
So, you know, I believe that this attitude, certainly not your attitude because you tried the film, you filmed the guy and you made a brilliant film, which we'll talk about just in a second. But this general attitude is just making the problem that's dividing this country so much worse because...
Exacerbating the problem.
Yes, because, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but if the establishment is going to just say, we're shutting you people out, you're not even worthy to have a discussion with, it's just like saying, you're deplorables, we're not going to have anything to do with you, and it's just confirming everything, their entire worldview, the entire Bannon worldview expressed in your movie is ratified by the fact that you can't get the movie distributed, I think.
Well, I agree.
Let's talk about the movie. So what does American Dharma mean?
His obsession with cyclical history, with Dharma, which he defines for us in the movie is duty, destiny.
Fate.
Fate. What do I make of all of it?
What does he think his Dharma is? I think I know the answer, but I wonder what you think.
To change the world with a heady dose of destructiveness thrown in.
Right. This was a big thing for you in the film. A couple of times, two or maybe three times, you basically said, I'm paraphrasing, you can correct my paraphrase. You basically said, I just don't see the point. It just seems to me to be destruction when he's talking about his view of elite institutions, to be reductive again. And you just said, it just seems so destructive. And I think that's your take on his program.
Well, it's not just my take on his program.
No, but we're talking about your movie. I mean, in the movie.
No. It's based on things that Steve Bannon says in the movie and has said elsewhere as well.
I agree.
You know, when he says, you know, in order to change things, we're going to need some real killers. This is war.
He talked about Trump as a armor-piercing missile. He used a lot of military metaphors.
Indeed. So to say that this is just something that I have seized on.
No, no. I mean that, I was just saying it was a large theme. It is. A large reaction of you to his policy.
It is at the heart of it, I would say.
But at some level, so this is, I want to talk about, so at some point in the movie, Bannon says, he states his platform. He describes it as three verticals. Stop illegal immigration and protect workers. Bring back manufacturing jobs. Get rid of foreign wars. Now, set aside immigration. He did say illegal immigration. But what's wrong with that program from your perspective?
Not much.
So do you believe him?
Although I kind of like immigrants.
He said illegal.
Illegal and legal. I like them both. Both flavors. Why not?
Do you think we should have borders?
Yes, I think we should have borders. But do I think that they should be somehow armed borders with walls and moats and a portcullis here and there? I told him at one point, I didn't put it in the movie, I said, you know, I'm in favor of the wall. And he said, well, how's that? I said, because I'm really kind of disgusted with what's going on here. I'm planning to move to Mexico. And the wall is the only thing that's going to keep those fucking American psychos, rapists, and killers out of my new country. Bannon came to Boston. I noticed he's reading a book on the Great Wall. And so I comment on it. I said, you know, it really worked, didn't it? And he looks at me again. And I say, no Mexicans in China. And that time I actually did piss him off.
He lost his temper.
He didn't lose his temper, but he was annoyed.
The point I'm trying to get at, set immigration aside. On the surface, and I actually think in reality to some degree, Bannon much more than Trump. I think Bannon is the pure version. I think Bannon's populism, much more than Trump, has a large progressive element to it.
It does.
And I don't understand. There was a disconnect in the movie for me. Disconnect's not the right word. A small disconnect. He kept pounding, and you edited the movie, so you gave it these balances. But he kept pounding the fact that, you know, a carnage, American carnage, of the forgotten worker, the displaced worker, the forgotten citizen. And you kept talking about how destructive it was, and you would put up on the screen things like you're emphasizing in your background shots the kind of internationalist implications, pulling out of Paris, pulling out of the Iran deal, pulling out of NATO, maybe. And I didn't think you engaged him adequately on his, what I think is, it may be huckstery, it may be real, and I don't think he's really got a plan, but I think it's his real focus on and interest in the typical American worker.
So I have a Croatian cameraman, Igor Martinovich, a good Croatian name, and a really good cameraman. So Bannon and he are having a discussion about the Balkans. And Bannon is telling him things are so much better in the Balkans since they got rid of Yugoslavia. And now they're all of these independent nation states. And Igor looks at him and says, are you kidding me? It's a disaster. It led to carnage. Genocide?
You're talking about the state? The nation state did? Is that the idea?
No. What happened to Yugoslavia? The end result was not so good. Maybe I'm just stupid. I wouldn't rule that out as a possibility. But if memory serves me correctly, that all of these separate nation states in the 20th century in Europe led to bad things. So Am I, you know, to use the dreaded word, am I a globalist? Do I believe that there should be some kind of international cooperation and mediation? Yes, I do. And do I see people who are trying to destroy that as frightening? I do.
So I think that's an exaggeration. I mean, certainly that's their rhetoric, that they're trying to destroy international institutions. And some are on the chopping block, certainly. But the truth is, you know, he's pulled out of the Iran deal, a deal made without the approval of the legislature. It was lawful, but it
didn't have the sanction of the legislature. It was very easy to reverse for that reason. He pulled out of the Paris deal. You know, you have the backdrop pulling out of NATO and the world or something like that, but he's not going to pull out of NATO. He's threatened all sorts of things. And he does have a, I'm talking about Bannon and Trump, they do have definite commitment to the nation state as the unit of analysis, so to speak, in international affairs. But
as long as they agree with the policies of the nation state, yes.
You know, Trump has said in his, he talked out of both sides of his mouth as presidents who want to do, but he said we want nationalism for everyone except for the handful of states we don't like Venezuela, Iran, and the like. But that's a typical American. I think that there's been a huge overreaction to his anti-internationalism. The truth is, I mean, he's been much more destructive, in my view, with regard to his posture towards allies and his performances at the United Nations and the G7, the G20, and places like that, than what he's actually done to these institutions. The truth is he's weakened our position in these institutions.
Well, yes.
But not weakened them, really.
Yes. But that's just stupid. Not for want of trying.
I don't even think he's tried very hard. And on some of the stuff, I mean, you know, we could get into the particulars. It goes beyond the scope of your movie. But on some of the stuff, there's every president since Reagan, if not before, has stood up to NATO and tried to get them to pay more dues. Trump's been a little bit more successful on that front because he's been a lot more obnoxious. There's a consensus now across parties that what's going on with China is kind of necessary. I'm not defending the general program. I'm certainly not defending the attitude. But, and this is to bring us back to the other two films, it's not like American foreign policy for the last few decades had been going swimmingly.
No.
And this is the
point. Nor would I ever argue.
And of course you wouldn't, but this is the point. I think this is an important point. So Bannon was, I think, he was really taken by the fog of war. It's one of the reasons he wanted to get into filmmaking. Is that right?
It is.
Congratulations. But he was also surprised in the movie. He was really surprised when you said you voted for Hillary Clinton. Because, and if I'm interpreting it correctly, he basically said, didn't you learn anything from your other two films? You know, what was the Fog of War and the Rumsfeld movie about, if not the utter failure of American elites with their exquisite rationality and managerial expertise? The utter failure of them to conduct foreign policy. Didn't you learn anything from that? Was basically what he said to you. And what is your response to that?
My response to that was, I was afraid of you and Trump.
That was the direct answer to his question, to his surprise that you voted for her. But he was making a broader point, I think. Maybe not, but this is what I interpreted it to mean. Which is that he was calling, part of his campaign to destroy the elite institutions is to wipe out the foreign policy elite. That your two films showed pretty brilliantly, he implied, was a disaster for this country. It led us into these two disastrous wars. And I think he thought that you hadn't I'm not saying this is true, but I think he thought that you hadn't understood the import of your films.
I like your interpretation, and it has not really been entirely clear to me.
I think that the way to explain Bannon, this seems really clear to me from your interview and from other things, is anti-modernism is exactly the right way to think about it. I mean, he talked about the algorithms that control our lives and the managerial class that control our lives and going back to smaller communities. And the whole vision is
my darling Clementine.
Something like that.
The American flags flying over the fort.
Right. But that's a very powerful vision for a lot of Americans. Why is a fight against elite institutions and even against frustration with modernity, why is that frightening?
It's frightening if it's crude, if it's bullshit, if it's a scheme in order to get power rather than true belief.
So what do you think on that question? On that question, I'm split. I actually tend to think, again, I'm talking about Bannon, not Trump. I think Trump is, Bannon has held these basic views before Trump came on the scene. Trump had his own views before Trump came on the scene. But Bannon has had these basic views, populist, anti-internationalist, nationalist, anti-modernist, pro-Judeo-Christian as he sees it, pro-Catholic in a certain way. He's had these views for a very long time, and pro-worker, anti-Wall Street, that whole cluster of views he's had for a long time, and he's pushed them for a long time. And I don't see any reason to question his bona fides on that, but I couldn't tell what you thought.
It's a little weird. Harvard Business School, Goldman Sachs.
It's not weird. He was reacting to that.
He said himself
he went to the belly of the beast and he learned these things.
So he goes to the biosphere. I don't get Bannon. I think that when I said to him that there seems endless contradictions in the views that you hold, I think you're crazy. I'll stand by that.
Let me give you a couple of examples where I think you may have misinterpreted. Or you took the obvious interpretation, but I think there was something else going on.
Well, I'm interested.
You were really taken when he finished the Milton statement in Paradise Lost. Rather reign in hell than serve in heaven. And that really struck you. And in one of your interviews, you said you've never actually heard someone admit that they wanted to be Satan. And it sounds like you took this as affirmation.
Well, it's a good line.
Confirmation that
in an interview, it's a good line.
Fair enough. But you took this as confirmation that Bannon really is Satan and he thinks he's evil and that confirms.
No.
So tell me, because I think.
No.
Okay.
My wife once looked at me and said, "You're a hyperbolizer." And I said, "Damn straight. I'm the greatest hyperbolizer who's ever lived."
But still, you were taken by that statement.
I was amused. Look, you didn't explicitly ask me whether I like talking to Bannon.
Okay, I'll explicitly ask you. Did you like talking to Bannon?
I did.
Because?
Because I find Bannon interesting. I find him often funny. He is an intellectual. I won't even qualify it. He's an intellectual. He's read a lot of stuff and enjoys talking about it, as do I.
But you're puzzled by someone this smart that could have these views, I think. Is that fair?
Yes. I think it is fair.
But isn't that revealing? Isn't that really
Of course
revealing?
It's revealing.
That's just an autobiographical statement of the kind of people you hang out with, isn't it? It does come through. The things that scare you in the film, the things that worry you, it seems to me that you have a perspective. It's nothing wrong with that. That's all I'm trying to say. And it's a particular one.
I'm a Long Island Jew, as I said before. I'm aware of all of these stories about Jewish emigration from Europe during the Second World War. Do I have biases about all of this? I most certainly do. You know, to be against immigration just seems to be wrong. And can I absolutely defend that position?
It's fine. I'm not asking you to.
I can't.
I'm not asking you to. All I'm saying is...
Yeah, you are, but...
No, I'm not. I'm definitely not. I promise you I'm not. I'm with you on that one, probably. Let me ask you...
I like the probably part.
Well, I need to know more about what you think. So let me ask you just a couple of wrap-up questions. You asked Rumsfeld. In the movie's called
The Unknown Known.
The Unknown Known, right. When you're in a position...
By the way, I have a version of Rumsfeld, which I like very much. The known funny, the known unfunny, and the frightening category, the unknown unfunny. It's really deeply unfunny, but you don't even know it yet.
And is that a description of him, you think?
He's not devoid of humor. He's...
I thought he was being very playful with you in much of that.
He is, actually. He's an avuncular presence, if that's the right way to describe it. I always compared him in the studio to McNamara. McNamara is not a politician. Rumsfeld is. So who goes around and talks to the crew? Who asks the gaffer, like, where he comes from? Who talks to the assistant cameraman? Rumsfeld! Rumsfeld does. Would McNamara mingle with the hoi polloi? No.
Doesn't surprise me about Rumsfeld. Let me ask you this.
He's always running for office.
I don't think he's running for it anymore.
Who knows?
You asked him, when you're in a position like Secretary of Defense, do you feel that you actually are in control of history?
Yes.
Or that history is controlling you? And he gave a kind of two-sided answer. But I want to ask you, it seems to me that all three of these movies... You've given these three important figures, in many ways reviled figures by many people, but these three very consequential figures, you've given them, I think, that why do these folks want to be interviewed by you? I think it's because they think they have a shot at shaping how history sees them. I think they all three were motivated by that to some degree. You think that you're luring these people in to reveal things under the false pretenses
of being their friend?
Their vanity? Yeah.
I think I'm luring people in under the correct assumption that I'm interested in hearing what they have to say.
And they think they're going to come out a winner, don't you think?
I don't know.
I have one final question. the McNamara movie, you're this looming presence off screen. Same in the Rumsfeld movie. But we see you. You're actually present as a questioner in the Bannon movie. Why did you make that decision? And why did you make that decision?
I got tired of the Interrotron, my interviewing device.
Would you explain just briefly what that is?
Well, I call it first-person cinema. Everybody who has done a filmed interview knows that there's a problem, an inherent problem. Where am I supposed to look? It's a question. Often you even ask at the beginning of the interview. Do I look at the camera or do I look at you, interviewer? Because you can't look at both at the same time. With my device, you can.
With the Interrotron.
Correct.
Right. But you still could have used an Interrotron and been... It seemed like you were using it. It seemed like Bannon was speaking into the... It was the same effect, wasn't it, or was it not?
No,
it wasn't. Oh, I'm sorry. But was that a result and related to you being in the film? Did you have to? I just wonder why
I didn't have to, no.
Yeah. So I'm wondering
why
your white-shirted presence was in that film. That's what I want to know.
I wanted to do something different, I think is the main reason. And I had the correct feeling, that this would be more obviously adversarial than anything that I had done before.
And it was more adversarial?
It was, because I say things to him.
Yeah.
I didn't say to Rumsfeld, I think you're crazy. But I did say that to Steve Bannon.
This may be unfair, but did you have to do that with Bannon to be able to do the film?
No, I toyed with the idea. In fact, we did a little piece with the Interrotron. I was debating whether to use the Interrotron really till very late in the game. Hard to know why you make certain decisions.
You just have a feel for a movie, and you go with it.
I like the fact that no one really comments about this aspect of the movie. I would often describe my movies as an effort to get inside someone's head, an effort to see how they see the world. I decided very, very early on, because we had to build a set, that I wanted to put Bannon in 12 O'Clock High.
That he chose that movie. Among others, right?
These are the movies which he chose. I didn't choose any of these movies.
You should explain. So you asked Bannon to give you some films that he admired, and you kind of worked those films in.
Books and films that he admired.
And you worked those into the project.
And 12 O'Clock High, which he first saw at Harvard Business School, was arguably his favorite movie. I'd never seen it. All the other movies I had seen.
I'd never even heard of it.
Multiple times. I had never seen 12 O'Clock High, and I see a lot of movies. Certainly, I see a lot of 1940s and 50s American movies. And I thought that 12 O'Clock High, I saw it, was amazing. I still think it's amazing, and I've seen it many times. And I like the idea of making a set out of this and putting Bannon smack in the middle of it.
In kind of a quasi-military fatigue type, whatever that outfit was.
Well, I didn't dress Bannon.
I know, but he kind of looked the part, if you know
what I mean. This is like what you get.
Yeah, okay.
You get the white shirt.
But if he'd shown up in a suit and tie, it wouldn't have worked with that setting.
The chances of him showing up in a suit and tie were nil.
Right.
We had multiples, variants on the Bannon theme, but he wouldn't go near any of it. And that was the joke, of course. People say, well, why does he have to wear three shirts? I think he has a similar problem to the problem I have based on reality, is that we both know we're fat and would like to hide that fact in some way. I think the Interrotron probably is a way to hide myself from view. And I decided that this time I would take that risk. I would come out from behind the curtain.
Does it have a deeper meaning, though? I mean, because you were a little more aggressive in this interview. I mean, were you saying, I'm going to do this with you, Steve Bannon, but it's going to be me more personally as present with my opinions more on the surface?
Yes, but I like the fat interpretation better. Why the three shirts? Well, one person on set said, well, it's obvious to hide the tail.
I think that's a good place to stop.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please take a minute to share the podcast with your friends and followers on Facebook and Twitter. give the Lawfare podcast a rating and review wherever you listen to us, and head to thelawfarestore.com to pick up mugs, t-shirts, onesies, challenge coins, and other Lawfare merch. We're looking for a fall intern here at Lawfare. If you're a college student looking for a job in Washington this fall, head to our website to find information on how to apply. The deadline is Monday, June 24th. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.